So Job, where we're at, Job is responding to Eliphaz. He's responding, we're in the first response of this interaction between him and these three friends. And he tells them, and I really like this, you know, verse 17, he says, talking about, you know, friends here, he says that, beginning with verse 15, my brothers have acted deceitfully like a wadi, like the torrents of wadis which vanish, which are turbulent because of ice and into which the snow melts. And when they become waterless, they are silent. When it is hot, they vanish from their place, and the paths of their course wind along, and they go up into nothing and perish. So he says his friends are like a wadi. Now, we don't have a lot of those, I guess, around here. We have some creek beds. You know, every now and then you have creek beds, and they're pretty empty most of the year. We call them gullies at that point, right? And then, but there comes a point where there's a lot of rain, and they end up filling up, right? But they don't stay full long. They tend to go back down and eventually be even dried out at some point. In the deserts, you have these. You can actually see where they wind through the desert. But, you know, and for a time, water will come, but then water will go away. You know, he says, you're like that. He says, you know, if I come up on you at a particular time, you know, it looks like you're going to be something that's worth, you know, refreshing, something that's going to help me. You know, I'm walking along in the desert, and here's this stream, and I go, wow, here it is, this is going to help me. But it only lasts for a little while, and when it gets the hottest, when I need it the most, is when it goes away. I remember being up in Tahoe, and if you're in Tahoe at certain times of the year, the American River is just flowing big and large. I mean, it is fast flowing. It's just roar. You can hear it from a long way off. But other times when the ice isn't melting in the Sierras, it's not that strong. You know, it depends. And so here he is. He says, I thought you guys were going to come here and be a refreshment for me, but all you have been now is I am starved for help. I need something that you're not being able to or not willing to give to me. He goes on down in verse 24. Job says, teach me and I will be silent, and show me how I have erred. How painful are honest words, but what does your argument prove? So Job asks Eliphaz here, you know, Eliphaz, and we're going to see Bildad did the same thing, Zophar did the same thing. They keep going, well, if you were righteous, this wouldn't be happening to you. You must have done something. But there is never a time in which they're able to say, Job, we heard you did this, or Job, we saw you do that, right? There's not been any actual accusation of what the wrong is that Job has committed. And so Job says, just tell me. Give me one thing that I've done wrong. And if you can give me one thing that I've done wrong, I will sit silently and I will listen to your reproving me. I will listen to instruction. If you can just tell me what I have done wrong. He says, you know, those words, you know, honest words are sometimes painful, but, you know, I will listen to them. But your argument's not honest. You're making a supposition that I have sinned because I am suffering in some particular way. But while honest words may be painful, I'd rather have honest words than your supposition. It's never an easy thing to have someone tell you that you've done wrong, is it? I mean, those are hard words to hear. Even when you know it, know that it's right. You know, there's still that inclination in us, right? That little moment, hopefully it's just a moment, where we want to just rebut it and just deny it, right? Where we want to get mad at the person telling us so that somehow we can deflect them away from our action, what we know to be true. Hopefully we're able to overcome that and listen, as Job says here, to listen honestly to what people, or listen silently to what they're saying so that we can be better and do right. Well, we go down to chapter 7 then, as Job continues to talk about the calamities and the need for them to reprove his words. But Job speaks of the difficulty of life and the shortness of life beginning in chapter 7. He speaks about the bitterness of life. He says, is not man forced to labor on earth, and are not his days like the days of a hired man, as a slave who pants for the shade, and as a hired man who eagerly waits for his wages? So I am allotted months of vanity, and nights of trouble are appointed me. When I lie down, I say, when shall I rise? But the night continues, and I am continually tossing until dawn. My flesh is clothed with worms and a crust of dirt. My skin hardens and runs. Life is hard. Life is difficult. And that began where? The Garden of Eden. That you will work by the sweat of your brow, right? You know, when God placed Adam and Eve upon this earth, He put them in a garden. Now, they were to tend and to dress and keep the garden. I hate yard work. I probably wouldn't have liked it much. But they were to tend and dress. But everything they needed was right there, wasn't it? From every tree we can eat. But sin removed them from that place where God just provided it. And they just had it there for them. You know, it's very similar to what we even look at when we look back to, or we look forward in the Bible, to the Israelites and how that God provided for them, right? Walk out in the morning, pick it up off the ground. You don't have to go to Lowe's or to Harris Teeter and fight all that mess. Just go pick it up off your front yard. I'd take that today. How about y'all? I like honey-tasting bread. So, you know, yeah, I'd take that. But He provided for them. Their clothes never wore out. I'd love that with suits. If I can work through a suit. I've gone through a few in 20-something years, and for 40 years, their clothes never ran out. Or never wore out. Did I say ran out? Wore out. That didn't make sense. Their clothes never wore out. God took care of them, and yet they turned on Him. And they sinned against Him. Same thing, Adam and Eve are completely provided for. They got everything, and they sin against God. And God says, okay, now you're going to pay a consequence for that sin, right? You're going to have to work. You're going to have to go out there. You're going to have to sow and you're going to have to reap. And we do that to this very day. Sin brought that kind of toil and that kind of labor at any rate to this world. And Job speaks to that. But life is hard and life is hard because of that. Now, Job certainly is speaking from a deeper life is hard moment. I mean, Job is certainly talking from his pain right now, right? His difficulty right now that he's going through, the loss of his children, the loss of everything that he has. This terrible illness that he is suffering is certainly where this is coming from when he talks about how hard life can be. You know, he says, I cannot sleep. You ever have those nights where it just seems like you wake up hourly? You know, you wake up and you think surely it's close to morning, right? It feels like I've been asleep a while. It's 1 o'clock. Wake up again, it's 2 o'clock. And you know, you just don't get any good rest that night. It just seems like you were constantly waking up. Never did really get into that kind of deep sleep that helps you get fully rested. And you wake up the next day and you're tired. Job says, that's how my days are. You know, the night just needs to go on and on and on and on. And then I'm tired. I can't sleep. Well, he's covered from head to toe with sores, right? One time I got really bad sunburn when I was in college. And there was no way I could turn or lay to where I was comfortable. It hurt so bad. And you know, we've had, you know, if you've had back pain I've had 3 broken ribs, it's hard to find a comfortable way to lay for any period of time when your back hurts or your ribs hurt, right? Job may very well be speaking of that problem, that the pain in his life is making it where he can't even sleep anymore, and that makes it even harder. You know, it wears us down even faster. You know, he speaks of in verse 5, and we know that he's scraping, he's putting dust on these sores, and he's scraping them, but you know, apparently they're becoming infected from the way, the very graphic language that he uses in verse 5. Verse 6, he says, my days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle and come to end without hope. Remember that my life is but breath. My eye will not again see good. The eye of him who sees me will behold me no longer. Your eyes will be on me, but I will not be. When a cloud vanishes, it's gone. So he who goes down to Sheol does not come up. He will not return again to his house, nor will his place know him. You know, Job says, life is short. Pretty soon you're not going to see me anymore. Jesus made similar statements, right? Soon you won't have me anymore. I mean, he was talking about the fact that his life was coming to an end. Job says, you know, it's not going to be too long until I'm not around anymore. I guess, you know, if you're as sick as Job, you probably feel like death might be just around the corner, right? Sometimes we have pains, you know, our chest hurts or something, and we worry. How close is life's end? And so Job here says, you know, there's coming a point where I'm not going to be around. I'm going to die because life is short. He says, because of that, get a therefore in verse 11. I will not restrain my mouth. I will speak to the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. He says, because I'm going to die soon and it could come at any moment, I'm going to make sure you know exactly how I feel, right? I'm going to put it all out there. And he does. Over and over again, he lays out his anguish of spirit, his desire not to have been born, his desire to have been stillborn. We're going to continue to see that in further responses, that Job is in such pain. He says, I'm going to make sure that you understand the gravity of my pain so maybe you'll have some sympathy. I mean, maybe he's fishing for sympathy. He wants them to be more concerned about helping him than sitting there condemning him, right? Because it's just going to get worse in regard to that. Their condemnations and their accusations are just going to gradually grow worse and worse. They're going to call him an idiot, empty-headed. I mean, man, with friends like this, you don't need any enemies because these guys are not that helpful. He says, am I the sea or the sea monster that you set a guard over me? Later we see a reference to Rahab, and it's not the Rahab of Jericho that we would normally think about. It's actually a word that is used in regard to a sea monster that God restrains. And may very well be in response to his statement here about the sea monster. But what's interesting here, he says, am I the sea or the sea monster that you set a guard over me? You know, he's asking, God, do you see me as a really powerful opponent? Would anybody disagree, having gone, you know, we live close enough to the ocean that and most people probably have been to it. It's a pretty powerful thing, isn't it? And you walk out there and the waves are powerful. They hit you hard sometimes. You can get pulled out by a current and there's nothing you can do about it, right? It's a powerful force. He says, am I the sea? Am I some great monster? You know, that you feel like, God, you have to put this upon me? I mean, he really feels like it's a little bit of overkill. I'm not these things. It doesn't, you know, it's not really necessary to put all this on me. But that's the question in his mind. Does God see me as some powerful opponent to him that he would do this to me? He goes on to say that verses 13 through 19, that he cannot sleep. And because of his illness, he wishes that God would leave him alone and just let him die. Now, that's not him doing what his wife said to do, right? That's not cursing God and dying. I mean, you know, she said, why don't you just curse God and die? That's not that going on. This is him just saying, you know, end what you're doing to me, God, by just letting me die. You know, if it's punishment that is being brought up on me for whatever reason, if this is something that you think I deserve, then take it to its full end, right? And let me die. Just end my life. And so it's not a cursing type situation, but certainly an appeal to God. And then Job has, after that, he has some questions. Have I sinned? What have I done to you, O watcher of men? So he's talking to God here. He's saying, God, have I sinned? What have I done? What have I done to you? Because all sin is against God. Why have you set me as your target so that I am burdened to myself? Why then do you not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? For now I will lie down in the dust, and you will seek me, but I will not be. Why? You don't live very long in this life, do you? It's you don't pray why. There's nothing wrong with asking God why. Nothing wrong with seeking answers. You know, we are God's children, and how many people's children asked them why when they were growing up? There's nothing wrong with the question why. And God will answer those questions if He believes that those questions need answering the way that He answers them. But, you know, he asked God what He's done to cause these things to happen to him. And, you know, we can be passionate in our prayers just like Job is here, right? Really just pour ourselves. I mean, you read these questions and put the context into play here. Don't you think this is passionate? What have I done? Why is this happening? God, what have I done to you? And passionate prayer is good. You know, one of the things, I'm coming to you. one of the things that we see with Hezekiah, when Hezekiah prayed not to die, when Isaiah said, you know, set your house in order, you're a dead man, it's done. And he prayed to God, and God said, I have heard your prayer and I have seen your tears, right? God does pay attention to passion in prayer, as he did with Hezekiah and gave him 15 more years of life. Yes, absolutely. I mean, he never does deny God. In fact, he never does even deny that this isn't coming from God. I mean, he puts it that God is the one in charge, right? And even when he's, you know, when we think about that God is doing it, you know, we understand that in this particular context, he's allowing it, right? I mean, I guess you could say that that's very similar in some ways, but he's allowing it. And I think we're going to see as we go along, we see these responses, that Job's going to grow from this. That there are things that Job, certainly through this, is going to learn that he may have never learned before. We're going to see Job slowly begin to come around. You know, we've already seen that his friend says, you've said these exact things to people, right? And so if he said the exact things that Eliphaz is saying, and Bildad's saying, and Zophar's saying, if he said those exact things, he's been saying the wrong things, hasn't he? Just as they're wrong for him, they are wrong when Job was saying them. They were erroneous. The good do suffer sometimes, right? And there comes a point in just the next few chapters in these first set of responses where Job says, maybe the good do suffer with the wicked. You see him, and you begin to see this change, right? God's giving him wisdom in his suffering. He's learning something. And he would probably just as stubborn to someone telling him this, going, well, the good don't suffer. Or the good suffer. Job would go, no, they don't. God wouldn't let that. He probably would be just as stubborn as Eliphaz, Zophar, and Bildad are in regard to it with Job's statements. But now that he's living it and he knows he hasn't done anything wrong, it's giving him wisdom, isn't it? And so let's never forget that there is an element to this where even though God is allowing this, that Job is having the opportunity to grow and to learn something about God that he apparently didn't know before. Right? Suffering is not always a bad thing. It's difficult to go through. And it's, you know, just as Hebrews chapter 12 says, no one likes going through the discipline of God when it happens, or even when our parents discipline us. But I think there is an aspect where we look at the wisdom we gain from it. As children, when our parents disciplined us, there was wisdom gained, hopefully, that has made us into the people we are today. And when God disciplines, hopefully, we don't just become so self-obsessed that we fail to gain wisdom from the suffering that this life sometimes has. You know, whether it is from God or not, that's a question that, you know, we can't answer, and certainly becomes a question in this particular set. But, you know, we can be passionate with our prayers, even when asking, you know, we need to find hope with God in times of hopelessness. There was a preacher one time that, and I think this speaks to what you just said, Kevin. He arrived at the church building one day, and parking lot was full of police cars. And he got out and he asked a police officer, he said, well, there's a guy over here in the car and he has a gun. And he wants to speak to a minister. And he said, I'll talk to him. He went over to the car and the guy had the gun to his throat. He's ready to kill himself. The man says, don't do that. You've got to know that God loves you. And he said, where was God when my son took his life? Where was God when my son died? And the preacher said, the same place he was when his died. God understands. We need to find that hope. That guy did not kill himself. Hopefully, continue to find hope in the fact that God has suffered the same pain that he suffered. You know, Jesus Christ living on this earth, and that's going to come into play. Job's going to ask, I need somebody that can be between me and God, right? I can't contend with God. I need someone that understands and can take that to God, that can actually contend with God. We have that, don't we? Someone who lived this life, lived it in the trenches, knows the difficulty of life, knows the pain of death, knows the pain of sickness and sorrow and hunger and all these things that goes on in this life. Jesus understands them, and he's been tempted in every way that we've been tempted. We have somebody that understands. God understands. What a blessing it is as we go through suffering to know that Jesus has been there before us. Yes, ma'am. Yeah. I mean, don't we see that here in the book of Job? Doesn't God put limits on what can happen? There are limits, right? God says, I'm not, you know, and as we go through suffering in our life, if it, you know, if God allows a particular thing to happen to us in our lives, allows particular suffering to come upon us in our lives, as suffering is a part of life because of sin, but God still has the power to put limits on it, doesn't he? I'm only going to let it go so far. Just as he did here with Job. He put limits. Isn't that necessary? I mean, even when we think about 1 Corinthians chapter 10, that no temptation has come upon us that what? That we cannot endure, that we cannot handle. That has to imply a certain God putting certain limits on what can take place with us, right? Now, do we understand all that? No. Don't even pretend to. But It is what God's word says, that there, you know, there's not going to be a temptation beyond which you can handle. Now, we can make an argument in regards to temptations that there's always a way to handle a temptation, right? To resist it. But God does care. And he has put limits. And while it is terrible what Job is going through, you know, the very thing that Job is asking for is the limit, isn't it? You just can't take his life. I mean, but that's what Job's asking for. He wants his life to be taken. But that's the limit. It's interesting because that's the limit that God's put on what Satan's doing. You can't kill him. You know, before it was you can't touch him. Then it was you can't kill him. And so, you know, it's kind of an interesting thing. Job's actually wanting the thing that Satan can't do. Well, we can see kind of how this discussion is going, and we're going to try to accelerate, like I said last week at this point. We're going to see a lot of repetition in regard to at least the points being made. There's going to be said differently, and different illustrations are going to be used, but we're basically going to see similar things said by Job and of course, by his friends. In Job chapter 8, we see Bildad give his first speech. And there are three main points by Bildad. Point number one comes in verses 1 through 3, where it says that Bildad the Shuhite answered, "How long will you say these things, and in the words of your mouth be a mighty wind? Does God pervert justice, or does the Almighty pervert what is right?" So Bildad's saying here, Job needs to stop proclaiming his righteousness. Bildad rebukes him for the statements that he's made. You know, basically, the argument or the point is, if Job is righteous, then God is perverting justice, that the righteous suffer, right? Now, that's from Bildad's point of view. Let's make sure, remember we said that what these guys say is their opinion recorded to us by inspiration. He says, God is perverting justice. If you haven't done anything wrong, Job, and this has happened to you, then God is perverting justice. So he's basically saying, you're either making God one who's not just, or you've sinned. Now, there's the choice, right? So that's his first point. So, you know, it's the same thought process we hear today, right? If God is good and loving, then why do people suffer? That's the same thought process or same found, you know, basic fundamental thought that goes into that same line of reasoning to this day, that if there is suffering, then God is unloving. See here, Job, if you're suffering, God is perverted justice. Today, if there's suffering, then God is not a loving God. And so that's where he begins. His second point begins in verse 4, where he says, if your son sins against him being God, then he delivered them into the power of their transgression. Now, a little different than Eliphaz. I mean, Bildad's going to bring up Job's children too. I would find that that's probably a very sensitive subject, don't you think? And while Eliphaz kind of ties it to Job, when he says, you know, if the righteous, they have lots of children. How many you got, Job? Right? I mean, that was basically how he came across on his. So therefore, you must not be righteous. But it's different than Eliphaz, because while Eliphaz blamed his children's death on Job, Bildad kind of just sets them aside. He says their children may have died because of their own transgressions. I mean, just, you know, while you're certainly suffering for that, Job, that may not really been you. So let's just, you know, I can set the kids aside. They may have committed transgressions against God, and God dealt with them in the way that he did. And in fact, he has to go there, doesn't he, to be consistent in his argument? If the children died, then they had to be unrighteous too, because they suffered a calamity from God. So he's building, he's trying to strengthen the argument by saying your children. Now, would you say that this was a concern of Job about his children? Chapter 1, was he concerned about his children and whether they transgressed God's law when they were having these celebrations? And they were having a celebration when it happened. So, very much probably on Job's mind. What were my children doing when it happened? Bildad just kind of touches on that as he comes out here and talks about the fact that if your children transgressed, then God dealt with them. And that goes that's very similar to what we read later in the Law of Moses, right? That the sons of the father does not translate to the children, children not but to the father, right? That the children are paying their own price for what they did. But let's look over here at you, Job. Look at your suffering outside of your children's death. What have you done? Why have your children died, and how does that translate to you? Point number 3, Bildad says, if you would seek God and implore compassion of the Almighty, if you are pure and upright, surely now he would rouse himself for you and restore your righteous estate. So he calls for Job to repent and seek his compassion, and that God will restore him. Now, there's truth in that. There's truth in that, you know, to come to God and we will be certainly spiritually restored. But if I am physically sick, I can go and get my sins forgiven, right? But that doesn't mean I'm going to get physically well. God will forgive. God will, you know, offer me that kind of forgiveness. Everybody dies at some point, don't they? Death. On odds, death is going to have an element of suffering with it, is it not? See, this is where the argument begins to have problems, right? Because everybody at some point, righteous or unrighteous, is going to suffer and die. Death comes from sickness and injury or the difficulty of aging. But all of that involves a certain level of suffering and difficulty. So there's a problem. It's a problem that has to be dealt with. But here he says, you just need to turn to God and it'll be all right. An interesting verse in verse 9, Bildad. And what I'm planning to do after we pass this first series of speeches is I'm going to try to take five verses from every speech to just kind of look at. And I invite you to do the same and see how many times our verses line up. But an interesting verse here in verse 9, he says, "For we are only of yesterday and know nothing, because our days on earth are as a shadow." You know, all we know really, right, is the past. Isn't that all we really know? I mean, I don't know the future. I don't know what will happen between now and the end of service, right? I don't know what will happen between now and the end of class. Preachers have dropped dead preaching and teaching. And we've had that happen just recently. So I don't know the future. The present is unfolding at the moment and becoming the past immediately, right? So what I know right now is already, by the time I just said it, it's gone, right? It's the past. Now I remember saying that to you just a few seconds ago. Very interesting verse when you think about life. That all we know is yesterday. Because our days on the earth are as a shadow. There's a thing in war called the fog of war. Anybody know what fog of war means? It means you can't see the whole picture, right? I mean, you can make a plan for an invasion. You can make a plan for an attack. But ultimately, there are things out there that could be unknowns, right? That you don't see, that you can't see. They've camouflaged it well enough that you don't know it's there. In World War II, they built an entire fictional army in the middle of England across the shores from Calais. And it was all blow-ups and just frames. There was not a tank one, but it looked like there were hundreds of tanks. And all kinds of, they were putting out fake radio messages. And it was all to deceive the enemy into thinking they were in one place when they were really somewhere else. That's the fog of war. And it worked. And life is like that. You can think you know what you're going to do tomorrow. But Jesus and James said you don't, right? Take care of today. Does anybody not have enough worries for today? Because you know what? If you got it all covered and you don't have very many, I'll give you some of mine. Right? Anybody else want to lighten their load? We're looking for that person that's got their worries all down for today. Deal with today, right? That's really all we can deal with anyway. This moment, at this time. Great verse there in verse 9. Kind of quick and then it's gone. Well, he summarizes what he's saying in beginning with verse 20. He says, "Lo, God will not reject a man of integrity." There it is. If you were a man of integrity, Job, wouldn't be happening to you. "God will not reject a man of integrity, nor will he support the evildoers. He will yet fill your mouth with laughter and your lips with shouting. Those who hate you will be clothed with shame, and the tent of the wicked will be no longer." Now, if this is true in every case, then Job has sinned and he is wicked. And that's why these things are happening to him. While Bildad accuses Job, he seems to, more than Zophar and even more than Eliphaz, he seems to try to give Job more hope. Right? Zophar is just kind of nasty. I got to be honest with you. He's just kind of mean. I don't want Zophar coming and telling me anything. But Eliphaz, while he touches on it, he doesn't deal with it as much. But Bildad always seems to say, you know, I want to give you a little piece of hope here. Maybe it's, you know, maybe your children are not your fault, like Eliphaz says, because that certainly would be hard for a parent to stomach. Maybe they're not your fault. Maybe they did their own thing and got their own punishment because of what they did. So that's not on you, Job. Let me just take that burden off of you that Eliphaz tried to put on you. Let me tell you, you can find hope with God. You can find healing with God. So Bildad seems to be, at least at this point, trying to encourage Job a little more than maybe the others, even though he does level the same accusations. And Job responds very differently to Bildad. I mean, he even admits, you know what? Can't really argue with what you're saying in a lot of ways. First, we look at chapter 9 and verse 2. You see the beginning of Job's response to Bildad. And you know, he's basically saying it's an honest question. In truth, I know that this is so, right? Now, exactly how much that he's implying here is kind of left open to some degree. But he says, but how can a man be right before God? Now, here is where Job's beginning to gain wisdom, isn't it? Only the right are not going to suffer. Only the right God are going to bless. But then the question comes in, how do I be right before a righteous God? See, he's beginning to think it through, isn't he? As he seeks to be, you know, ultimately, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Job knows he's sinned, right, at some point in his life, at different points in his life. And therefore, you know, that he's immediately not right with before God because of any sin that he's committed. Now, Job, being an upright and blameless man, has done those things commanded as far as sacrifices or what, you know, however God had revealed what they needed to do in the patriarchal time for him to deal with those things. He's obviously done those things, but he still says, I still know they're there. And ultimately, who can really be right before the righteous God of heaven? Anybody think Isaiah was a pretty good guy? I think he was. But in chapter 6, when he came before God, or the representation of God, well, I mean, no man has seen God, but the representation of God, first thing out of his mouth was, I'm a man of unclean lips, right? Man, I'm dirty. I mean, I'm sure Isaiah was keeping the law. He was a faithful prophet of God. I'm sure he was doing all those things necessary on the Day of Atonement and sacrifices, doing all those things. But still, he immediately came to understand and realize, man, when I stand before the righteous God, I look bad. I look bad. We're going to talk about being poor in spirit this morning in the sermon. That's a little bit of it, understanding the reality of who and what I am in the eyes of God. Job admits that Bildad is right about God's judgment on the wicked and his care for the righteous. But is it possible to live righteous before God? Romans chapter 3 and verse 10 says there is all righteous, right? None righteous. We sing the song. No, not one. Some translations say not even one. Psalm 14, Psalm 53 is where that comes from, where the psalmist says that no one does good. No one. Not even one. And you know, so, you know, when people claim, well, I'm a good person. No, you're not. No one does good. Jesus makes us good, doesn't he? Jesus makes us righteous. Left of myself? No. But with Jesus, it makes all the difference. And so Job is understanding this it's beginning to go over into his mind here about how do I actually stand before God and say, I'm good. Listen to Job then describe the power of God. Great text. Verse 3. If one wished to dispute with him, he could not answer him once in a thousand times. I love that. Let God ask a thousand questions and you'll never answer one of them, right? Well, I mean, just statistically, you think you might get one right? He says, you ain't going to even be... And Job's going to come to understand this more clearly than probably any other man on earth, right? When God does come and ask him, I don't think it's a thousand questions, but he asks him a lot of questions. Job said, I'm just going to shut up. Because what can I really say? He says, wise in heart and mighty in strength, who has defied him without harm. No one defies God without there being a consequence, right? Now, we don't go as far to say that it's necessarily something that necessarily might happen in this life physically. There are consequences. Romans chapter 1 makes it very clear that sexual immorality or living against God, that there is a penalty within ourselves. Not talking necessarily spiritual there, but talking about some kind of physical penalty. There is a reason things are sins. They're not good for us in some particular way. Emotionally, physically, mentally, whatever. But here, you know, we see that he says that no one defies God without harm. We look back to Hezekiah, which we just got done studying about Hezekiah and the invasion of Sennacherib. And Sennacherib said, I've defeated all these other nations' gods and I'll beat yours. Hezekiah lays the letter out before God in the temple and says, God, have you noticed what he's saying? Did you pick that up? Why don't you prove him wrong? Sennacherib woke up the next morning, 185,000 of his army were dead in their tents. He had to go home. Because God said, I'm not going to be defied by you. Belshazzar defied God by drinking and partying with the utensils from the temple of God. And he saw the literal handwriting on the wall, and his life came to an end that very night. You know, he goes on to say, it is God who removes the mountains. They know not how. When he overturns them in his anger, he who shakes the earth out of its place and its pillars tremble, who commands the sun not to shine and sets a seal upon the stars, who alone stretches out the heavens and tramples down the waves of the seas, who makes the Bear, Orion, and Pleiades and the chambers of the south, who does great things unfathomable and wondrous with works without numbers. How can we, this is what Job is saying, how can I compare myself to that? How can I ever stand before that and have some kind of arrogance of saying, I'm so right, right? Now, I feel like, tell me if you feel the same way. I feel like sometimes when I pray, I feel like my requests are so petty. Petty for a God that's bigger than the universe to even listen to, right? I ask for things that are so small in comparison to his power, in comparison to him. But it's his love that hears those petty things, right? How many of you have had children? You think Patrick's doing his job, give me the two signal. How many of you have children, and when they were small and they asked for silly things that didn't matter, but you still listened, didn't you? And you still acted like you were interested? Why did you do that? You're so much bigger, more knowledgeable than that. Because you love them, right? God hears my petty little request. He hears your petty little request because he loves us. And he brings his power to bear on those petty things. And don't you think he can handle them? I think so. That's what Job is pushing here about God. So we'll pick up right there. Jim, you're right. I'll just listen to you from now on.